Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. It's Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. We're all good. How you doing?
I'm good. I just, before we start anything, it is 9/11, yes. September 11th, and just to all the people out there who were directly affected or indirectly affected, we just feel for you. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a good day to remember that. It's also the Jewish New Year.
Yes.
Yes. So Shana Tova to all those who practicing Jews mm-hmm. or cultural Jews or spiritual Jews or...
It's so funny because, you know, my younger son's addiction to sugar, and he's like, are we going to celebrate Rosh Hashanah? He can't say it, but he knows that there's honey involved. And so he's all about it. I'm like, well, you know what? We might just do apples because Remy, of course, is vegan, so we can't have honey. So I'm like, we might just do apples. And he's like,
oh, you can't have honey?
No. Honey comes from bees. He won't eat it. It's anything from an animal.
Wow. Yeah, insects included.
Very strict.
So even though they don't kill, it doesn't kill the bees.
It doesn't matter.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So does he research all this or do you know all this and you tell him?
No, I tell him nothing.
Because you
because it's too hard. I don't know how he gets this information. I really don't. But yeah, isn't that amazing? So anyway, so now London, of course, has no interest in apples just by themselves. So anyway.
And now, just to be like his big brother, does London ever say, I'm going to try vegan also?
He said it before, and then like 2 minutes later, have a bite of hot dog. So I don't think it's going to go very, very strong on that one.
Does his brother have any issues with
him eating meat?
Yeah.
I think he has problems with everyone eating meat. And it's really funny because, you know, I'm a vegetarian, but I eat fish, and he'll really get on me for eating fish. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm at least, you know, staying away from red meat. I was like, get on your dad. Like he's the real meat eater. It's like really funny.
So you're a pescatarian.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. I'm a pescatarian plus fowl.
Right. Exactly. So I think there's another word for that. Yeah.
There probably is. Yeah. 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 Oh, so I have some good news. Prowler gained a half a pound from his last.
Oh, that's great.
He stopped puking for the most part. He seems to be doing better. They hope that his pancreatitis is better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, like I said, that we still have a full 2 weeks, if not 3 weeks, before we get the next ultrasound. But we're rooting for him. I just keep sending you pictures. Isn't he the cutest with his little mohawk?
He is
belly mohawk.
Stunning. Like that cat, I swear to God, I always say this could be on commercial. Both your cats. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I know. Oh, and how about Moosey?
Moose is hanging in there. You know, these are our pets, by the way, not our children. He's hanging in there. He started the medicine. I don't know how much it's doing so far, so I'm going to have to call the vet to see, like, does it take a while to kick in, or...
Is he still agitated, though, begging for food all the time?
Yes, talk about gaining weight. This guy is just going strong. I mean, oh my God.
He's going to be moose times two?
Yes, he really will be. It's moose like caboose? Scary. For a whippet? Oh my God. I mean, it's like, I forget, like, what they're really supposed to look like. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's like a lab. So
I got to tell you, have you seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians?
I'm dying to see it.
It is fantastic. I saw it this weekend. I thought, oh, is this going to be like a
racist?
Yeah, I was worried about that, but everybody's going, no, it's really, really cool.
Funny.
And it's so funny. It's in my top 10 favorite movies now.
I'm dying to see it. Okay, it's on my list.
Yes, you cannot take the children to that.
No, please. I'm looking to see. I honestly cannot even remember what I did this weekend. It's so scary. What did I do? What's today?
It's Tuesday.
Today's Tuesday. What did I do this weekend? Oh, my kids had a play date. Two boys over. So it was a complete and total craziness for a few hours. And then I went to a baby shower that, get this, this is so fascinating. She had a sex educator at a baby shower. So here's my friend who's 39 weeks pregnant. And she has this woman pulling out like dildos and sex toys. It was... It was absolutely like hands down the most interesting baby shower I've ever been to.
I love it.
Isn't that cool?
Yes. Was it all women?
It was all women. Mm-hmm. And it was just like really funny because there was a point where like the sex educator is getting really into it. And my friend who's pregnant was like,
I can't do this.
You know what? Like we're trying to eat our tiramisu here. Can we just like put a pause on like the anal plug conversation right now?
Now she's the one who hired this person or is this a friend of hers?
She knew about it, but I think she thought it was more of like a sex therapist who you could ask questions to, and not like a person who sells sex toys.
All the accessories.
Yeah. So it was really interesting. So fun.
Fun. Okay. Well, let's see. Last week we had Dr. G, Deborah Gilboa, and she wrote this fabulous book, How to Get the Behavior You Want Without Being the Parent You Hate. Loved her.
She is amazing, and I absolutely, like, hands down, I just read her book cover to cover.
Did you?
The whole thing. And it was phenomenal. It really was. And I've read a lot of parenting books, and what I like about her is I feel like when it comes to parenting, there's two different camps. There's like the really lenient, like hippity dippity, you know, and then there's like the really intense, strict, and I feel like she's in the middle to me, where she's compassionate but she's firm. And I really liked her insight, and there was a lot of great ideas. Like, I was highlighting some stuff, and I just loved her personality. I loved that she raised four boys.
Yeah.
So, you know, kudos to her, and anybody who wants some good parenting advice, it's a wonderful book.
Right, and it gives you sort of a sense of relaxation that there's so many things at your fingertips that you can do that will yield a positive result, that it isn't like one size fits all where you have to do this, you know, like sleep training kids. I mean, this is like a whole science now.
Yes.
And it's like, wait a second here. You know what? Let the kid kind of figure out its own rhythms.
Yes.
You know? But anyway, so she was fantastic. Okay. Without further ado, drum roll.
Okay. So today we have Dr. Adam Ghazali, and he is the professor in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at the UCSF and the founder and executive director of Neuroscape. Dr. Adam is co-founder and chief science advisor of Achille Interactive and Jazz Venture Partners. He's been a scientific advisor for over a dozen companies, filed multiple patents, authored over 130 scientific articles, and delivered over 600 invited presentations around the world. He wrote and hosted the nationally televised PBS special, The Distracted Mind, with Dr. Adam Ghazali, and co-authored a 2016 MIT Press book, The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. He's the winner of the 2017 Prose Award. He's received many awards, including the 2015 Society for Neuroscience Science Educator Award.
Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good. Hey, I just want to say, can you help us understand what is an ancient brain? What exactly does that mean?
Sure. So as we all are aware, our brains evolved, and although they allow us to do these amazing things that feel very modern, like program computers and build technology and fly around the world and into space, they are still in many ways those same ancient brains that we evolved from. And so when we look at our behaviors and behaviors that might be confusing and perplexing to us, many times we could find the answer by looking at other animals and sort of reaching back into our evolutionary past to try to understand why we might behave in ways that might seem illogical if we try to reason out why we act that way.
Mm. Is that because of different components of the brain that are still there, like the limbic system or the reptilian brain? You know, I know the brain is divided into different sections. Does that contribute to that?
Yeah, that's one example of it. Yeah, I mean, you know, we didn't get rid of a lot of the basic machinery. We just added on top of it. So, you know, the limbic brain, you know, which is more of like our emotional center, a lot more reflexive, is a part of our brain that is conserved through so many other species, and you could see that express itself in how we behave. You know, some of the things that I focus on in terms of an ancient brain is related to that. It's our reflexive response to certain stimuli. So although we have what we call top-down attention, meaning that we make decisions and then have a goal and direct our attention where we want it to, we also have this other aspect of attention that we call bottom up, and that's things in our environment that happen to be really important or really powerful, like a flash of light or your name, which you've become, you know, quite accustomed to, that demand our attention independent of our goals. And we call, you know, this is an ancient part of our attention system because it is essentially what allowed us to survive, right? Where we could find food and avoid toxins and predators by the stimuli. And most animals, most other animals, still are acting very reflexively to their environment based on bottom-up stimuli. And we have not gotten rid of that. We still have this bottom-up attention that, you know, demands our focus, even if we don't want it to. So you might be having a conversation and you feel a vibration in your pocket or see a message come in, and you could, you know, sort of see this in our technologies, use a lot of these cues to pull your attention away. So that's one, that's another example of how our brains are very ancient and how it impacts our daily behavior.
So this is so funny. When I think of ancient brains, my mom's going to be so mad at me, but I just have to share this story. I think of my mom. I remember it was like the 90s and when like CD players came out, and she goes into Best Buy and she's trying to buy a CD player. And she says to the man who's working at Best Buy, she says, "Oh, you know, I'd love to hear this music. Can you play it for me?" And so he plays it and she's like, "This is nice. Can you flip the record over so I can hear the other side?" He's like, "Lady, it's a CD player." Like, it's just so funny. So I just think of that when I think of like ancient brains, like my mom, that's like, so like, cute. How many W's do I type in here? Like, what's going on? It's just so funny.
Yeah. Now we even mean more ancient than that.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you say bottom up attention, you're just talking about, let's say we're getting distracted with our cell phones and things like that. Is that also that you could be at an important meeting and all of a sudden your hunger cues go off and your stomach starts to growl? Would that be a bottom up attention?
Yes, that's another example of bottom up attention. That's an internal stimuli, a physiological stimulus, but it is still something that you didn't have in your goals.
Right.
You didn't decide that you're hungry. Your body let you know. And, you know, bottom up stimuli internally could be even more complex than that. It could be sort of ruminations and thoughts, often negative, that your goal is not to pay attention to them, but they sort of get right in there. You know, so you're having an important conversation, let's say with your boss, and it, you know, unwillingly your mind goes to this thought of a fight you had with your significant other, and you know, it's there even though you really wish it wasn't. So that's another type of sort of bottom-up stimuli, non-goal-directed stimuli. And we often call them distractions because mm-hmm. they could create interference with accomplishing our goals.
Mm. So how come you decided to write this? I'm just going to like change topics for a minute because I'm so curious. Do you have like a personal interest in this, and in what way?
Well, I've been, my background is I'm a trained as both a neurologist and a neuroscientist. And for, I guess, 25 years, I've been studying the aging brain. And once I moved my research from animal models of neuroscience, which is the most traditional, to studying the human brain using functional imaging, this was in 2002 when I moved from the East Coast to California and started at Berkeley, I wanted to ask questions from our research lab that I felt were really important to people in their daily lives. And I became really interested in attention and also the impact of distraction and then eventually multitasking on our behavior. But I wasn't asking these questions in a real world way, like how does using Facebook while you're at work impact your performance, although I find that very interesting. Mm-hmm. I was asking it from a neuroscience perspective in a laboratory setting. So I would design experiments where we would have research participants of all ages, although we did do a lot of research. A lot of our research studies focused on healthy older adults, like 60, 70, 80 year olds. And they would lay inside an MRI scanner, or we'd put EEG electrodes around their head to record how their brain was responding. And then we give them a very simple goal, like, here's a face. Remember this face. You have 7 seconds. And then 7 seconds later, is this the face or is this not the face? And then what we would do is just introduce really subtle little forms of interference, like another face that pops up in the middle or another task that they have to do in the middle, like identify a nature scene. And what we found, which we've known for a while, is that even subtle distraction and other tasks degrade performance on a very simple task, like just remembering a face. What we did was show what happens inside the brain that causes that interference and how it gets worse as we get older. So that's what I was doing for, you know, running a lab here at University of California in San Francisco for many years, describing the neural mechanisms by which we are impaired by distractions and multitasking. And then the connection with the book, The Distracted Mind, was to take that story and just blow it up and tell the full larger picture of not just how our cognitive abilities, like our perception and our decision-making and our memory, are impaired by subtle distractions and multitasking, but how this has been reflected in our real-world behaviors, like school performance and driving and work and our relationships. So that was the idea of the book, The Distracted Mind, to tell the bigger story about how we're very sensitive to interference all around us and how technology has been a big part of that story.
It's interesting. It reminds me of, we spend a lot of time in, you know, the criminal world having eyewitnesses trying to point out, you know, the person that they saw, the perpetrator. And aren't we like the worst at being eyewitnesses because of all these interferences in our brains?
Yeah, there's a whole field on legal aspects of neuroscience, and that being one of them, especially children. There's this whole field of false memories and how they could be essentially implanted, even non-intentionally, by, you know, seeing, you know, a lot of, like, an example is you might have this memory of childhood and only come to learn that it's because you saw a picture of that event. And your memory is really of the picture that over the years has become sort of mistaken as the memory of the event itself. And so, you know, a lot of views of memory is that our memories are of the last time we remembered it and that recreation of it and not the original event. So you can imagine how many opportunities there are for a memory, especially when being interrogated and in a highly, let's say, emotional moment where, you know, memory is already being challenged, that a memory could go in an entirely different direction from the reality that originally generated it.
So I'm going to switch topics for a minute because I'm a daily meditator, and I'd love your thoughts about the research on meditation and cognition.
Sure. So we talk about a little in the book, and we do research related to meditation here at Neuroscape, which is our research center at UCSF. And, you know, there is a long, really rich history of meditation and its positive benefits on a whole range of health and well-being metrics, from attention and cognition, which is what I focus on, but also stress and mood and sleep, compassion, empathy, you know, all these many aspects of how our brain functions that are critical for living a healthy life and having a healthy society, maybe even as importantly. You know, for many years, these were really experiential practices, you know, from ancient traditions that had these benefits, but maybe without a lot of classic empirical research. And now that has changed dramatically. There are many research studies that have documented these benefits, even in controlled studies. We're very interested at Neuroscape. What we do is we try to turn the story around of technology as something that challenges our brain, as we were just discussing, to an opportunity, new types of tools that can be used to enhance our cognition. And so one of the ways that we go about accomplishing that goal is to create interactive experiences, not unlike meditation itself, that target different brain networks. And then through repetition and adapting the challenge can really help improve those abilities. So we have a video game that we created called Meditrain. It's more of an app than a video game. It's not yet that sophisticated in terms of rewards and things of that nature, but it basically teaches you how to do traditional concentrative meditation, which involves focusing on your breath, being aware of your mind wandering, and returning your attention to your breath. And it does so in an adaptive way so that you baby step into it and get feedback on how you're doing. And then we do research on it. And we've even shown, we're actually writing a paper right now that millennials, so 20-year-olds and early 30-year-olds that were in our study, we showed that after 6 weeks of engagement in Meditrain, we improved their sustained attention abilities. And this is compared to a placebo control group. So we're really excited about bringing in ancient practices like meditation, which is essentially an attention exercise, and sort of reinventing it in a format that's very accessible and deliverable through technology.
Mm, I love that. Yeah. In contrast to that, I'm going to ask a question that's probably completely unanswerable. However, maybe you can stab at a component of it, which is, as you're saying about meditation, I'm thinking, but oh, so many people, they don't read anymore. They don't meditate anymore. They don't relax anymore. They're consumed with social media. Is social media making us dumber or smarter?
Well, you know, like you're right, there is no strong answer on that. And largely because, you know, the research is still very new. The technology is new and it's changing all the time. In general, the easiest answer is sort of like the nature nurture question. There's always one answer to that. It's both. And everything is both, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even the things that are the best for us, like physical exercise, can be abused to the degree that it's detrimental.
Sure.
You know, so I'm a very yin yang person, how I think about the world. And, you know, and social media has opened up incredible opportunities for people to connect in other ways that they could not. We're all aware of that. But it also has introduced exposure to information that maybe was best if you didn't know. It's created large amounts of anxiety, as well as even associations with depression. It has challenges on productivity and performance. So, you know, there are challenges that were maybe unanticipated. Here's a technology that the hope was that it would connect the world and unite us and maybe create more coherence between us. But in many ways, it often creates the opposite. So it's our job to get out in front of that. I mean, ideally, we would have been out in front of that, but at least to take stock over what's happening now, and then to do it better.
Well put.
Well, it's so funny because I remember I was a senior in college, and my paper was on, is the internet, does it connect people or drive people away? And this was in the year 2000 when, like, it just kind of, wow. Like, I feel like, yeah. So
was it just theoretical or did you actually do research?
No, I mean, it was just theoretical. And I mean, I can see both sides. It's kind of funny because I can see how it can connect people and then I can see how it can make you isolated. So it's interesting how it is both.
It's all about that balance,
yeah,
isn't it? If you just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Adam Ghazali. Did I get it? Ghazali, yes.
Yep,
the co-author of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. I'm so curious, you know, I mean, I have historical roots as to why I became a psychologist all the way back in early childhood. I am curious if there was anything in your childhood that drew you to neuroscience. You know, were you just by nature so interested in how the brain worked, or what kind of sparked that interest?
So I grew up in, I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Queens, and I had no exposure to any doctors or scientists at all when growing up. No one in my immediate family had gone to college. I was just not embedded in that world. So I didn't really have those, you know, personal role models, but I became really interested in science, largely due to a combination of watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos, which I know influenced many of us scientists from back in those days, mm-hmm. to reading science fiction like Isaac Asimov, to taking trips to the Museum of Natural History. And basically from 7 on, I was just obsessed with this idea that I was going to be a scientist when I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was just because I was really stubborn, but I never changed the answer to that question of what you're going to be when you grow up. And I stuck with it. But for most of my young life, I thought I was going to go along the Carl Sagan route and work, you know, in astronomy field. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, I guess, when I was an undergrad, I shifted more to biochemistry, which was my major. But it wasn't even until sort of the end of undergrad that I discovered an interest in the brain. And then it was a sort of random event that just sparked it in my mind. And then, you know, that's what I've worked on ever since, for like 30 years now.
Wow.
I love it.
And what can you tell us about the aging brain, and what can we do to preserve? Because I know you did a lot of research on that.
Yeah. So, you know, the bad news, which I've spent most of my life working on, now I work on the good news, which is that our brain is plastic and can be improved. But the bad news is that just like every organ system in your body, there are normal So we say normal is non-pathological, non-disease related, although it's often a very blurry line. But let's call it a normal process of aging that occurs. Your hair changes color, your elasticity of your tendons change in your bones, calcium, you know, all these changes that occur in your body occur in your brain as well. And when we look in the laboratory at changes in cognitive performance, we see a whole host of decreased abilities compared to younger adults and likely compared to where you were if you look longitudinally earlier in life. Now, it's not all abilities that show these declines, but there are a lot of them. So anything demanding like great flexibility or quick speed usually declines to some degree. Even processing speed in general decreases almost with every year. But abilities like working memory, which is holding information in mind, switching between tasks, multitasking, resisting distraction, directing attention, these abilities, which I've been studying for a while now, all decline with age. And not in absolutely everyone, but in a lot of people, enough that almost every researcher finds statistical differences between younger and older adults when you test these abilities in the laboratory. Now, there are some things that are preserved with age, like semantic knowledge about the world around you or vocabulary, even things that improve, like wisdom. So it's not all gloom, but a lot of the abilities that you that people often need in highly competitive situations like the work environment do show this change across the lifespan. Mm-hmm. So that's the bad news. And we publish dozens of papers on that and what happens in the brain, you know, from a neural point of view, how neural networks change and the engagement of a part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex, as well as the hippocampus involved in memory. But the good news is that our brains have this phenomena that we call neuroplasticity, which is the ability of the brain to modify itself at every level, from its structure, its chemistry, its physiology, all in response to experiences. It's not the only way the brain has plasticity. We also respond to damage and injury through responses that are plasticity to recover from them. But plasticity, in terms of how experiences change us, is the entire basis of all learning, that your brain, you know, gets better and more optimized at interacting with whatever in our environment might be challenging it. There was a long period of time where we thought that this process of plasticity essentially ended after critical stages of development, where the rest of your life was just in decay in terms of your brain. But we now know that the brain retains plasticity, although it does reduce throughout our lives. And so I look at that as an opportunity to find ways to challenge our brains, you know, through the entire lifespan to help maintain these abilities at least at a high enough level that you still have whatever quality of life is important to you. And for some people, you know, it might not demand super rapid processing speeds, but I find for many older adults that I interact with, they are really demanding their brains in ways that they did when they were like teenagers, you know, trying to learn new languages and travel around the world and start whole new careers. So with that type of demand, we see like a real challenge of how do we find ways to keep the brain, you know, functioning at as high a level as possible throughout our entire lives.
A great concrete example of that would be like somebody who suffers from a stroke and they lose their capacity to speak, but then eventually with speech therapy and such, another part of the brain can take over speech and they can actually recover some of their ability to speak.
Yeah.
Yes.
That would be a perfect example of plasticity.
So
I, you know, even if you're a 65-year-old and you decided that you waited your whole life and now's the time to learn how to play drums, it's not going to be easy, not as easy as if you were seven, but you'll learn. And that's another example of plasticity that's retained throughout our lives.
I just have a personal statement here. So I have a lot of younger friends, like younger by 10 years younger, 15 years younger, 20 years younger. Some were my supervisees that, you know, they've sort of become their mentor to some degree. Do you think that helps keep us younger? Because it feels like it does to me. Like Kelly, she and I are, what are we, about 15 years apart? But, you know, I can hang with you, right? I'm there with the best of you.
I didn't even think about it. It's so funny.
But I really believe that. Do you think there's anything to increasing your plasticity by going younger?
I think
I mean, in some ways, you know, some of it could be social aspects of, you know, keeping up with, you know, changes of society and ways of interacting. You know, I think university professors keep an edge like that because they're around young people all the time. So they're constantly knowing what the latest trends are, whether it's technology or music or just the way people interact with each other. So some of it might be that. But, you know, the other aspect of it is, you know, more general cognitive challenges. Our brain, you know, responds to those. And that's sort of the whole goal of our research program, is to come up with these new challenges through technology. But there's many ways you could challenge yourself in real world without, you know, special tools to keep your brain functioning at a high level, right? So we know that, you know, there's lots been written about travel and all the, you know, fun but often uncomfortable moments that happen when you're on the road and out of your element, but also interacting with people that are younger, even socializing in general. I mean, there's lots of data that, you know, loneliness being an aspect that often occurs associated with aging, you know, decreases longevity itself and has lots of detrimental impact on our health and well-being, including our cognition. So, yeah, you know, I think all of these, you know, ingredients in the real world, like social interaction, but also exposure to nature, physical exercise, a good quality sleep, the cognitive challenge more broadly, these are all the ingredients that we now understand are important to keep our brains healthy, you know, for our whole lives.
And can you talk a little bit about the research on music and cognition? Because that's fascinating to me as well.
Yeah, sure. I was just actually at an event at the Kennedy Center in D.C. called Sound Health 2018, where the entire meeting was on music and the brain. I actually gave a talk there and did a demo of one of our new rhythm video games that's in virtual reality. And we did it with Mickey Hart, who's the drummer from the Grateful Dead. So we put him in a VR gear and he played the game on stage for everyone after my talk. And, you know, basically what we're doing there is sort of capitalizing, similar in a way that we've done with our meditation research, on real world practices. So there's lots of data that music exposure, especially as someone that learns how to play music, has benefits on your brain for the rest of your life in terms of how you process information, how you filter out noise, benefits on language. But you see a lot of positive benefits on aging. And so we're trying to dissect out what elements of music are doing that and try to understand if we could deliver those benefits in other ways for people that might not want to learn a musical instrument. So here we are taking rhythm, which we think is a critical component of why music has so much benefit on the brain, not the only one, but we do think it's a very important one, and trying to weave that into this full body motion capture virtual reality experience as a new tool that can be delivered to get the benefits of rhythm. But now we enter the long research phase as we finish up the development to figure out if that hypothesis was true.
Awesome.
And I have a very random question. I have the worst sense of direction, I think, on the planet. I have the sense of direction of an infant.
I will concur.
She will concur. Like, and I'm curious, is there an area in the brain that has to do with, like, sense of direction? And because there's just no other explanation for my horrible spatial skills.
Yeah, I mean, spatial skills are a combination of a lot of different abilities. So your memory system, which is part of the temporal lobes, the hippocampus, but also your parietal lobes involved in spatial attention. So the spatial attention, the spatial memory, and they come together to create that complex navigation skill that we all rely on, all the time. And there's lots of variability in it, just like there's lots of variability in people's rhythmic skills, as we've been discovering in our research. We actually have, it's funny that you would say that right after we talked about our rhythm game, because we have a navigation VR game. Our only other virtual reality game is a sort of a wayfinding way through a game through a city where you put on a VR headset and you actually walk.
Poor Kelly, she's getting anxiety as you speak.
Yes.
and you basically have a virtual cell phone in your hand that has a list of tasks, like go by the bank, stop at the post office, you know, and you have to do all these things by walking through this city.
Wow.
And we're assessing, the program is assessing the efficiency of you getting through the city after you've learned it once, right?
Wow.
So you do it once, you learn it, and then you have to keep doing it until you reach a level of proficiency of navigating. And then you graduate to more and more complex cities. Now, this is meant to be a tool that we think will hopefully improve memory abilities. And we're looking at it in older adults that are at the earliest phases of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
But it also winds up giving us a very interesting metric of spatial navigation abilities as well in everyone, and allows us to ask maybe not as complex question as can we improve memory in general, but just can we make someone have a better spatial memory? So that's an interesting study that we're just about to begin.
It's fascinating.
That's fascinating.
But so it's funny because I feel like I have a very good memory overall, but when it comes to direction, is that part of the memory different?
Yeah, there's so many different types of memories, and you know, they use different aspects of our brain and different networks in our brain. So it's possible that, you know, memory that involves that for you that involves spatial information might be deficient, where memory for faces maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're still trying to understand more about that variability, you know, across different memory systems within an individual. But you're right. They're different networks. There's
mm-hmm.
overlap, but they're not identical. It's not like just this one mm-hmm. memory chip in your brain that underlies all the complexities of what we consider memory. So, you know, there's memory encoding, memory retrieval. There's, you know, short-term memory, almost what we call working memory
mm-hmm.
and long-term memory. So, yeah, it's super complex and it does vary within individuals. But I always go into this with the optimistic idea that we can improve any ability.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we'll maybe be able to improve your spatial navigation, but it's still an open-ended question. No one,
she'll say,
no
God
one has done
help
that
you.
Yet.
Oh my God. Well, and the rhythm. I need both. I need both of your VR games because I have no rhythm either.
Kelly, truth. When you lived in Maryland, where you grew up, did you have a better sense of direction there?
Not really.
Because this area right here is a hard area to learn.
No, I wish I could tell you that that's what it is, and I appreciate your trying to help me. But there's a joke between my best friend from home. She's like, Kelly, you've lived here. I don't know why you made a right when you should have made a left. I'm like, I can't explain it to you. I don't know. And she thought it was like the weirdest thing that I just can get lost so easily. So
you've been coming to the show, well, which you've come to for 4 years.
Maybe we'll have you down to the lab and we'll do some research to try to figure it out.
100% would be the guinea pig.
So, and I know it's very common for people in their 50s, 40s, even 50s, 60s to start losing the capacity to remember names. It's like the tip of the tongue phenomenon. You can see it. Like I can see a face that just never leaves my brain. I can see somebody that I haven't seen 15 years or 20 years and totally remember where I met them, how I met them, what they talked about. But gosh, I'm having trouble with remembering names. And I know that's pretty normal. When do you think that it becomes when you know that it's like a problem or it's associated with the possibility of early onset dementia?
Are you forgetting my name?
Well,
no, Kelly.
There's a lot in there, so I'll try to unpack it. So the first is just about naming in general, associating a name with a face. You know, it's surprisingly a very hard task for everyone in some way. You know, it feels like it's the most natural thing in the world because it's such an integral part of our whole social network system. But I mean, if you think about what it is, it's like essentially a random association between a name and a face, right? There's no real thing that connects them besides the fact that we're telling you that this is the person's name. It was different in days where your last name was Smith because you were a blacksmith. But now there is no real association. And so random associations between two items are actually very difficult memory tasks to do. And we're being asked to do them all of the time. And so, you know, that's the first thing to recognize is it's a hard thing to do, even though we take it for granted and feel like we should be good at it because it's just so important and so common. But it's actually difficult. And so as you get older, as we said, the you know aspects of our attention, which is part of it as well, and our memory system decline, some of the things that become most obvious are those that are difficult and frequent, like names. So at least that's my view of it. You know, other things are also having problems, but you might not be exposed to them as often, and they might not be as like awkward and then as embarrassing as it is to walk up to someone and forget their name, especially when you have to introduce them. So, you know, I think that's why names get so much, you know, face time when it comes to this type of problem. But it's not, you know, anything special other than that type of change in memory and the challenge of having to do it. Now, at the very end, you threw into the question, how do you know when that's normal and when that is something to be concerned about, like in terms of dementia, Alzheimer's disease? And, you know, that's another really complex problem, not that just people face when they're looking at themselves and trying to understand how they're doing and if there's anything concerned about. But even for us on the medical side, neurologists like myself that see patients, it's also a challenging problem to know whether or not this is really something concerning. And the reason why is because, as I mentioned, most people suffer a decrement, at least to some degree, in cognitive abilities as they get older. And there's lots of variability in there. Some people are what we think of as healthy or normal, but they might be on sort of the worst end of that. And then, of course, you have the onset of Alzheimer's and other types of dementia that occur with aging. But these are very slow processes that happen very gradually and also have lots of variability in terms of the speed at which they come on. And then this is all made worse that we don't have any clear 100% indisputable biomarker that says you have Alzheimer's disease. Mm. Unless we actually look at your brain pathologically, which we can only do with a surgical procedure. And that's something we never do for Alzheimer's. It's just too invasive of a procedure. So we're left, both the patient and the doctor, in the very earliest phases of, we don't know. This looks concerning, but maybe it's not. And we're going to take a really nice picture of your brain, both how it looks under an MRI scan and maybe how you're performing cognitively. And then at least we have a baseline now to detect changes over time.
Got it. That's great. Yeah. Maybe we can shift gears a little bit because I know this is a very important part of your message. What are digital therapies?
Yeah, so we have this whole exciting area that grew out of our work. So, I sort of mentioned before, like the bad news about getting older is that a lot of our cognitive abilities decline. And then I said there's a good news side to this, and that's that we have plasticity. And as I mentioned, we have been building interactive experiences, usually delivered through video games, but not necessarily, it has to be. It's just that video games are a very fun way to have a digital experience because there's lots of reward and story and music and art if you do it well. But the essential idea, and I started this a decade ago when I first asked the question to myself and my laboratory, could we build an interactive experience that improves the cognitive abilities of older adults? Mostly focusing on attention because that's where my research had lied, before that. And what we found was that we could create these games to challenge different aspects of cognition. And we call them closed loop video games because they're closed loop. The game is always looking at how you're performing in real time and then using that data to update the challenge that you're getting. And so what we have found over the years is that we can document the ability of people, healthy people sometimes, many older adults have been in our studies, to play our games and get cognitive benefits that are meaningful and often enduring, you know, for months after the training period. And so what we're doing now is trying to take this to the next level to create what we call digital medicine. So effectively now we largely have pharmaceutical medicine, which deliver molecular treatments. Digital medicines are therapies that deliver experiential treatments, where we challenge your brain in this very targeted, personalized way and show benefits. So what we're doing is, after we develop one of these tools, these video games that are targeting these different systems, we do, you know, a whole series of experiments to show their benefit in the most rigorous of ways. We do double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials, just like are done for drug studies. We now have a game. It started as NeuroRacer 10 years ago, which was focusing on older adults. And now I started a company called Achille to get this out of my lab into the real world. And the game is now completed a phase 3 clinical trial for the treatment of pediatric ADHD.
Wow.
And is now in the approval process by the FDA to get approved as a medical device, essentially, to treat attention deficits in children diagnosed with ADHD, which would make it the first ever non-drug treatment approved by the FDA for ADHD, and the first ever prescribable video game, and the first of a new category of digital medicine.
That's amazing. Both my boys have ADHD, so you have my attention.
You have
my attention. I'm like, I'm interested.
Great. That's well, hopefully next year. That's, you know, it's a long process, but I've been doing this for 10 years now. This is just the very end of this pathway, but hopefully we'll have this on the market, prescribable by physicians, just as stimulants are now as a treatment.
Wow.
And we'll keep making it, you know, better and better over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it'll be reimbursable not long after that. But that's the goal, to advance a new type of medicine into the marketplace. And we also have studies on depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and more, you know, dyslexia, Alzheimer's disease, early Parkinson's disease, just on and on. We're encouraged by data showing that these types of treatments could have real real benefits.
Amazing.
So we're almost out of time. Yes.
Know.
Maybe just a quick response to what are your views of the future of cognition, really quickly?
The future of cognition. Well, you know, it's basically an extension of what we've been talking about. I think that we have been building technology, really amazing information technology, for a while now to amuse us and to help us communicate. And now is the time that we need to think more deeply about how do we use these amazing and accessible tools, you know, accessible meaning all over the world, we can distribute them to help improve our cognition, to take all of these abilities that we struggle with as they decrease with older adults, to maintain them at a high level. You know, we don't fully even understand how high we can improve these abilities like our attention and memory. But I'm also really encouraged about other aspects of our cognition, like our empathy and compassion. It feels like we need that now in the world more than ever before. Maybe every generation feels that, but I certainly feel it. Mm-hmm. And so these are other aspects of cognition. How do we regulate our emotions and our aggression? And there's a lot to be done. It's a massive field, but I'm encouraged by what we're already seeing in the lab. And it seems like, you know, I live right here in San Francisco. We're surrounded by, you know, amazing behemoth tech companies. It seems like a lot of them, from my interactions, are also wrapping their heads around that this is a really great thing to do with technology in the coming decade. So that's what I'm excited about.
Thank
Fascinating.
You so much. Oh. We've been talking with Dr. Adam Ghazali. He is the executive director of Neuroscape and the author of The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World.
How can people find you?
I have a website now, Ghazali.com. My wife helped build that, acts as a home base for all my activities, from books to, you know, my lab and companies and my photography. I'm a nature photographer as well.
Nice.
So that's probably a good home base now.
You know what? I think I found you. I'm wondering, I think I was reading an article in Real Simple. Does that sound familiar? Did they quote you or something in Real Simple? Like, I saw you in some sort of magazine and that's how I came across you. So I guess you're...
I do a lot of interviews because,
yeah,
you know, I'm excited about trying to translate science to the public. It's
uh-huh.
just become a passion of my life, and the stuff we do is very translatable, mm-hmm. because it uses tech and it's really very applied, so I do a lot of interviews. So that's probably probably true.
Well, you've been an awesome guest, yes. So informative. Thank you so much. So everybody, go check out that book, The Distracted Mind by Dr. Adam Ghazali. And okay, so next week we have Lane Delphin about dreams. Have great dreams.
And it's good segue from the brain to dreams.
I love it. I love it. Okay. And visit us on Instagram at Two Shrinks and Facebook, The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. And however else you want to find us.
Exactly.
Okay. We love you.
Take care.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.